SBS Radio.
This response is based on a project that CSI and First Nations Foundation did together last year with support from National Australia Bank. We're interested in looking at what financial resilience, or how people bounce back from financial shocks, looks like for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And it was based on those findings from the research that we are sort of identifying now where there might be particular vulnerabilities or risks specifically to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and trying to highlight where it might be that policy that is being rolled out in response to COVID is not necessarily going to meet the needs. So, for example, one of the main things that we reported, which probably isn't news for a lot of people, but in how wealth is understood in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, was very much described as something that was shared. And to be rich or wealthy meant to have a good community and having a full fridge and not having to worry about money. But for many of the people that we talked to, wealth wasn't so much about accumulating assets the same way that a Western conceptualization of wealth might go. And that's important because when we're talking about something like developing a safety net or developing savings, that requires an accumulation of assets. And so if there's a more of a sharing economy that is going on, which involves things like humbugging or sort of sharing with family, that can lead to issues if then you're faced with financial shocks down the track and you don't have a safety net to fall back on. So we found that half of the people that we spoke to didn't actually have any savings. And this isn't necessarily an issue if you've got a community around you that you can draw on when you are facing financial shocks. But if everyone's going through that same shock at the same time, something like COVID, where there's a decrease in or a downturn in the economy, that potentially has really negative impacts for both the individual but the community as well.
Yeah.
The other thing that we're saying is that it's really important to consider access to appropriate services. So what does it look like for people living in remote and rural areas, and are they able to get access to the same services that people in urban regions might be able to get?
When you say sharing, a lot of people, because some words that we use in media or in the community tend to have a different meaning, because nowadays they think that's really trendy. Everyone talks about the sharing economy and all these gig economies, but sharing means something completely different when it comes to First Nations communities. It is.
Absolutely, yeah. And, as a disclosure, I'm not Indigenous myself, and that was a really interesting and enlightening thing to come across. And, especially in remote communities where we did some field work, to hear people talk about, if I've got any leftover money, that is when I will pass it on to my granddaughter, or, it's just normal for people to come and stay for an undisclosed period of time. To talk about humbugging as something that happens that isn't necessarily annoying, but it does have financial implications. So it's not the same as the sharing economy that we would talk about in sort of a gig economy or Uber and things like that, but it's very much more about, if you've got enough to look after yourself, it's about then sort of focusing on how you can help out others.
Yeah, it's about solidarity, actually, within the community. And these are the networks that keep a lot of communities going, especially in times like these.
I can see
what happens in where people live with extended families. And
absolutely. And we definitely saw that, especially in the remote communities that we visited as well, where, and this was where we tended to have conversations with people as opposed to an online survey. But that was where we were seeing, women that we spoke to would talk about their grandkids that they were looking after, and if it was that they didn't have any money left, then they would just go fishing for the next few days until the next paycheck came in.
Yeah.
So just being able to kind of have the knowledge of the land and to be able to be a bit more self-sufficient, I think, is a really valuable and under-acknowledged aspect of it, I think.
Yeah. Another thing that people talk about a lot because I cover the news all the time. When we cover the news lately, everything that comes from the U.S. is very popular. We always say, Americans, an average American doesn't have $100 to survive in case of emergency. But we rarely speak about these conditions back home here in Australia. Mm-hmm. And, having the minimum just to survive in case of emergency, here we consider that $2,000 would be a minimum requirement to just be able to cope for a few days. But not all the people have that amount readily available.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing as well is, like, what's the $2,000 for? So if it's a sorry business, that could be, you know, travel, and it could be an extended period of time away. It could just be to replace a fridge or a washing machine. So, you know, $2,000 was spoken about as big money, and I think it is for a lot of people. And so I think as well, considering that $2,000 in a remote community means something very differently to $2,000 for me living in Sydney. So, you know, considering when we think about, like, the stimulus packages that are being offered in response to COVID, where, you know, people that are receiving government support already are getting a doubling amount and getting $750 extra, you know, what does that buy in Kununurra compared to what does it buy in Sydney because of food costs and things like that? So I think there hasn't necessarily been a much of a consideration at that end, you know, in terms of access to services and how appropriate stimulus packages are when you consider things like household size, when you consider things like remoteness and stuff like that.
It's widely well documented that cost of living is much higher. The groceries, the grocery bill is 75% dearer than what it would cost to buy the same amount of things in urban areas.
Absolutely. And even things like, you know, if you are in an area that is using a cashless debit card, you know, most of your income is quarantined to a particular card that you can use only in certain areas. But, you know, if you wanted to go to a farmer's market or a roadside stall or something like that where it requires cash, that might be a bit cheaper. You know, it doesn't really give you that option. So in a lot of ways, choices are restricted by having most of your income put on a debit card.
What are the aspects of these lockdowns that affect First Nations people more than others?
As a non-Indigenous person, I probably can't speak to that as well, but if we're sort of thinking about what it means for access to community services and access to, you know, volunteer organisations, might be, you know, sort of food help. You know, we've been talking with First Nations Foundation, and they're hearing that people that are seeking financial counselling that might normally do it face-to-face are now having to do it over, you know, video chat or something like that, which is then actually resulting in higher data costs for them. So there's an unexpected financial implication for it. And so if we're shutting down services, particularly in rural and remote areas, is there appropriate infrastructure in terms of, you know, interpreters, if there's a phone line that is put in place, you know, access to appropriate data or internet, that means that people can still easily access the services that they need. And I think as well, a lot of these services or responses, if they're just being sort of applied in one way in terms of like telehealth or, you know, banking services and stuff like that, is it considering the ways that, you know, as we've talked about, Indigenous people, you know, have different ways of approaching things like finance or how they sort of distribute resources. And I don't know that the response to COVID is necessarily taking that into account. And so that could then lead to disproportionately negative outcomes for First Nations people.
And it's also been observed that financial literacy can be a challenge for many in the community.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it's, you know, really important to recognise that there's a historical factor to that where, you know, it wasn't only until incredibly recently that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were actually paid for work that they did. And so there hasn't been that opportunity to generate intergenerational wealth or sort of learn about money within households and things like that. And so that just means that when it comes to facing economic stress, it might be that families that are First Nations people don't necessarily have the resources or the literacy to be able to respond in the way that you know, we might otherwise say is a responsible use of money or stimulus or something like that. So I think that has to be taken into account as well.
Yeah. One thing I didn't see in the paper is superannuation outcomes, because also, well, in all aspects, actually, the gap is wide between Indigenous communities and other communities. And superannuation outcomes is one area where the outcomes are really, there's a huge disparity between the communities. And one of the things that's being talked about now with COVID-19 is that people have the option to withdraw their money earlier that they would normally be allowed to. But
yeah,
Indigenous people are coming from a very disadvantaged start already.
Exactly. So they haven't had the opportunity to accumulate superannuation in the same way. And I think the other thing that we have to be really careful about is, you know, we've seen that there's been real estate agents that have been giving misleading advice to tenants to be dipping into their superannuation as a way to continue paying rent. And so, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there are other services that are also, you know, giving unethical or inaccurate advice, encouraging people and sort of relying on their lack of financial literacy to be making decisions like dipping into their superannuation, which has longer term impacts, but also things like taking out high cost credit, so payday loans and things like that.
Yeah.
What's the impact and how is that disproportionately affecting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people?
Yeah, that happens a lot because the most vulnerable and the people less literate about their finances fall victims to these payday lenders and things like that who have huge interest rates. And
yeah, definitely. And, you know, that was something that came out with the Royal Commission into the banking sector was that, you know, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people did seem to be targeted using sort of culturally appropriated terminology and things like that as a way of, you know, preying essentially on people that didn't have that same level of financial literacy. So I think that's something that needs to also be really attended to through this whole process.
Yeah. To sum it up, what would be the recommendations? What are the recommendations you're tabling to authorities to address this situation and all policymakers?
So I think the thing to take into account is, you know, putting an Indigenous lens or having Indigenous leaders responding to policies and recognising that one policy isn't necessarily going to be the most appropriate for Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. So we really want people to be paying attention to, is a policy caring for communities? Is it helping Indigenous communities access appropriate services? And are there also overarching supports in place to be able to target high-cost lending and misleading advice and making sure that that's not taking undue burden and impacting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people more than it should be.
And that's the recommendations on the paper. And all this information, is there a website where we can direct people to find out more?
Yeah, so the full fact sheet is on the CSI website, so csi.edu.au, and First Nations Foundation will be sharing it as well.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.